Good afternoon. This is Les Raker from the downtown Marshall and Madison County Days, and I'm speaking today with Taylor Barnhill, a Madison County resident, an architect, and someone who has been interested in the unique historical barns in Madison County, particularly, and that's what we're going to talk about today, and his work with sort of recognizing them, locating them, and advising people, and sometimes on how the owners can shore them up and maintain them. So, welcome, Taylor.
Thank you, Les. This is great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about maybe your background. I understand you're an architect.
I am.
You've been living here for some time. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I like many people, I discovered Madison County quite a few years ago. My first venture into Madison County was in 1974, and I was consulting with the Hot Springs Health Program through the Office of Rural Health Services in Raleigh. I lived in Raleigh and came up here to the mountains. I'd never really been in any of the mountains other than the Boone Blowing Rock area before. And coming into Hot Springs and Madison County was a remarkable experience. And I'm sure I share that with many folks who have moved here or moved back home to Madison County. I was an architect, a young architect at the time, and we had a program to develop rural primary care medical facilities in 30 rural communities around the state, and had a fairly unique program that involved more intensive design of facilities and using hands-on building committees made up of local folks to establish these rural medical centers. So it was a terrific opportunity for me to venture out into some of these beautiful rural communities. As a kid, I grew up working on an uncle's farm and always had a kind of identity with rural lifestyle. So it was a terrific fit for me at the time. The interest in rural lifestyle led me into a better understanding of what sustainable community development was and how an architect and planner could become involved in rural communities and really look at what rural folks needed, not what government programs told them they needed or what sort of the conventions of the day where they were headed.
Oh, could you elaborate on that a little bit? I've heard of urban planning, but I haven't heard of rural planning before.
Yeah, I think it tends to be a neglected area. My master's work was at UNC Chapel Hill in city and regional planning, but I had no interest in urban planning at the time. I really wanted to focus on rural resource development. And I was fortunate enough to be in a period of time where the whole concept of sustainable community development was coming together. And that really was looking at the economy, equity, ecology, we used to call it the five E's, energy, all of those things came together in a more holistic perspective around community growth, community health, and all the things that nurture a healthy community of people.
And you're pretty much talking about North Carolina specifically, or were you working or studying other states?
I was very fortunate to work all across the country. When I moved to Madison County, I had all this experience with this wonderful team of people out of Raleigh working on rural medical facilities, and so became in demand around the country to consult with other rural healthcare programs. The northernmost part of Maine, Montana, Arkansas, I was able to meet Bill Clinton back in the late 70s in Arkansas when he was a young governor there, working on a rural Arkansas health program, and realized that my experience in North Carolina also exemplified what was going on in rural communities all over the United States. It was a terrific education, and it just locked into my heart and mind my own interest in working in rural communities. And the planning component in most rural communities was missing. Back then, you know, everything was still dominated by agriculture. And we had, fortunately in North Carolina, we have these wonderful regional planning councils. Like here, we have Region B, Land of Sky. And they were providing staff to rural communities. When I first moved to Madison County, I was asked to be on the county planning board and had the wonderful experience of working with Ron Eller, who was teaching at Mars Hill College, and Dr. Don Anderson, who was here at Mars Hill College, and some other wonderful local folks who really understood sustainable community development. So I continued in that and integrated that into an architecture and planning practice, and that evolved into looking at energy in a very specific way in the design of buildings, and my architectural focus went towards solar, and passive solar design, and energy efficient design, and so that was what my focus was.
Was that integrated into the architecture, the solar passive solar panels?
It was, okay. And passive solar is really using the building itself to collect the heat and to dissipate heat and energy, rather than like photovoltaic panels, which are used for generating electricity. And then, so the Hot Springs Health Program building over in Hot Springs is an example that I designed back in the very early 80s, which was passive solar. It was designed to absorb heat during the winter time and to store it in the mass of the building and thus save a lot of energy costs.
Well, that was one of the first ways that architects were including solar, because we didn't, in those days, quite have the photovoltaic cells, the storage capacity that we do now. They're so much more sophisticated with, I don't know if they use lithium batteries, but certainly the battery and the capacity for storage of the energy is much more profound today than it was then. And I remember what you're saying, that it was, we knew that was coming someday, but in the meantime, architects were thinking about using earth to insulate, to build houses into the earth, to use darker colors in parts of the house, and then having windows on the south side, and all those kinds of passive ways that incorporated into the design that could utilize solar to maintain the temperature at least in a modicum level, so you don't have the extremes.
Exactly. You're exactly right, Les. The using the earth is one example. The Hot Springs Health Program building over in Hot Springs, and then the Laurel Medical Center, are both of which I designed, are both earth bermed buildings. So you bring the berm up to a certain height on the outside of the wall, and it serves as a heat sink and also tends to reduce the amount of heat gain and heat loss in the building envelope. So those are exciting times. I was very lucky to be part of the kind of the emerging solar industry back then. The sort of, as you say, solar voltaics were in their infancy and not cost effective at the time, and that's been the revolution recently, that they are now cost effective. But we, even with the Office of Rural Health Services, I was lucky enough to be on a team that designed and built the first commercial solar building in North Carolina, which was the Bladenboro Medical Facility. And we had an architect involved, Arnie Aho, who was the lead architect on the project. And it was very exciting. This was back in the mid-70s, mm-hmm. so wonderful times.
Right. Well, while we're talking about solar, how has that progressed in rural communities like Madison County? Are we seeing more of that with the new technology and solar storage and capacity?
We are. There is, however, a barrier to overcome. Right now in Madison County, we're part of the French Broad Electric Membership Cooperative, and because they are a business model that is about, in effect, profit, when you connect to the grid through French Broad EMC, there's this kind of diseconomy involved in people installing solar, because you basically have to sell back to French Broad EMC the excess power that you generate, and you're selling it at a discounted rate. And so the cost effectiveness of solar per se is not as great as if you were under a different kind of business model. So
right.
That's a handicap. French Broad has a number where they limit the number of people who can connect and get the benefits of being part of that grid. And we're still, there are many people who are trying to work through the changes in that. The changes is inevitable, but because of the current business model, it's kind of a disincentive.
Right, and I think their business model include perhaps the fact that it seems like I've heard this in the news lately, that they need to be able to pay for the wires and the infrastructure, and they want the homeowner then, whoever's generating electricity, to help share those costs.
That's right. There is a cost. There's an infrastructure cost that French Broad has always endured. And when a solar customer is not using that same infrastructure, there is that, in a sense, a diseconomy there. So that's one of the things that needs to be worked out.
Well, I have, I'm thinking maybe more broadly about solar too, and people using it for hot water and for heating and not for electric. Is that becoming more and more common?
It is. On the heating end of things, for example, if you have in-floor heating, you know, a tube system that is in the floor of a structure to heat the building, that can be generated by solar hot water. Now, solar hot water heating is very simple. It's been done for 100 years. In the early 1950s, 80% of the residences in Florida had solar hot water domestic hot water for, you know, kitchens and showers and all that kind of stuff. Countries like Israel have always had solar hot water. It's very simple, right off the shelf kinds of technology. And it's surprising to me that most people haven't gone more into that type of solar energy. And another example is that if you have an electric hot water heater, it's going to be one of your highest energy uses. A solar hot water heater, you know, it's just about free energy.
Right.
So you could reduce your electric bill tremendously just by getting off of an electric hot water heater. So photovoltaics is, of course, more limited. You wouldn't want to have electric heat per se with photovoltaics because of the huge demand that would be. But there's ways to balance out all the different energy sources and energy uses that are much more sustainable than before.
Well, like heat pumps and so on. There are lots of things that people are trying and doing.
Exactly. So,
and there's actually new wind sources too. And I've seen a lot of, well, I don't know if you call them experimental anymore, but windmills that are much more efficient than ever before, interesting designs to them for the homeowner. I've seen demonstration projects in Washington, I know, that are really incredible and can power. I remember years ago living in Pennsylvania, and they were back then, of course, we did not have the sophisticated storage capacity in solar, and really a lot of people who were kind of cutting edge said we really need to move to wind because it makes more sense for us living in Pennsylvania with all the cloudy days, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was the idea of sustainable, I forget what it's called, sustainable winds, the wind that you have prevalent all the time. Mm-hmm. You have to take into consideration, not just gusts of winds and storms, but it has to be, you have to have breeze all the time. And that's why today you see those really large windmill arrays on mountainsides and valleys where they can catch the prevailing winds. That's what it's called.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. These wind farms that you see, one of my previous jobs was with a conservation organization, South Wings, and we were able to fly all over the Southeast to help other conservation organizations. Mountaintop removal coal mining was one of those. So being able to see those large wind farms uh-huh. from the air was quite exhilarating. There are consequences to having a big, large commercial wind farm. There's, you know, there are vibrations, there's noise, there's a concern that they can be deadly to migratory birds.
Yeah.
And bats being very important to
our ecology.
I think
there's work being done on that to somehow discourage those flying animals from coming in contact with them. I know there's research at some universities, whether it's mm-hmm. with sound or whatever, to dissuade them.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of research being done. It's tough because yeah. you take a population of birds, for example, that have been on a migratory route for thousands of years. And this is in their DNA. This is cellular memory that they have. And to get them to go somewhere else is not likely. So you've got to figure that out. The offshore wind farms are also of concern. It's a terrific energy source. And I'm one of the first people to say, yes, we need to continue developing wind. But we've got to figure out some of the other consequences of it. We can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, number one, we have to just stop using energy that is not absolutely necessary.
Right.
We waste more energy than any country. We have these electric clothes dryers that are usually, along with hot water heaters, use more, you know, coal generated electricity than almost any other appliance, when hanging our clothes on a clothesline is perfectly...
I know, and that's called passive solar.
It's know? Another passive solar,
yeah.
exactly. So the technology is really important, but we're not... Climate change and our lifestyle is not going to be saved by technology. It's going to be saved by lifestyle changes and us getting smarter.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. I want to switch gears here and talk to you a little bit about the architecture here in Madison County, which is the main topic of our discussion today. And the rural architecture here is unique and exciting and interesting, and it's drawing a lot of attention recently. Would you begin talking a little bit about that? I'm particularly with the barns.
Yeah, it really does connect to this whole idea of rural sustainable lifestyle. How did people 100 years ago, or even 200 years ago, maintain themselves and their families in this rural environment with four very distinct seasons, with a forest resource that was fabulous at the time? And again, it's just like we've been talking about with solar and conventional architecture. It was about appropriate technology. I more or less closed down my architectural practice for quite a few years back in the early 90s because the mountain region was facing a lot of environmental threats, especially to the national forest lands around clear cutting and building logging roads and ending areas that might one day become eligible for wilderness. And so in working with these rural communities to develop campaigns to create more sustainable forestry practices, I really got to know more and more rural people all over the Southern Appalachian region and began to better understand the heritage that those families over many generations had been living. This is a living heritage, and they continued to work in ways that preserved their land, their water, their farmsteads, kept their families intact, and really worked at jobs that were much more sustainable. Now, there's aspects of all of that that many of us outsiders really didn't understand, and in some ways were perceived as negative mountain lifestyle. But when it came down to it, these were a generation of people that were still living principles of sustainability and being able to be self-sufficient. The classic junk car up on the cinder blocks in, you know, the yard of a mountain farmstead has a very negative connotation. But, you know, this is the first recycling. People didn't throw things away. That junk car had many, many usable components in it. And in most cases, it was continued to be used and reintegrated back into the flow of materials and vehicles. And my uncle had a junk car that was basically his starter seed bed. Where he started seeds for the garden every year, because it was a greenhouse. It was just like a solar greenhouse. And I know that kind of respect and understanding of technology has always been part of the heritage of the Southern Appalachian region. So, going back to Barnes, when I thought I knew a lot about Barnes in Madison County because I'd been all over the county. But when I really began looking at them close up and exploring their construction methods and that type of thing, I was amazed to find, in particular, a timber frame construction tradition here. Now, timber frame construction is sort of that, you know, New England barn where you have big timbers, post and beam timbers connected with mortise and tenon joinery and pegs and that kind of thing. And most people who love barns see that as a New England kind of tradition. It's not a real apparent here. Most of those building components in our barns, in our older barns, are hidden. And it wasn't until I began climbing around inside of these old structures, going back into the early 1800s, that I began to realize that Madison County did have a timber frame barn construction tradition. And that was big news. That was unknown by the folks at Archives and History and many other folks in the historic preservation community.
Okay, wait, before we get too much further into that, let's talk about the kinds of people that were making those. Where did they come from, and where do those influences come from? I mean, we're always saying this is the Scots-Irish heritage here in the mountains, but we know, of course, there are many people who moved to the mountains, Germans and, of course, African Americans later, and people from all over. But where did this kind of timber construction with the tenons and the pegs and so on, I mean, where did those people come from? Where did that come from?
It's a European tradition, and those European countries and cultures that were doing this for the longest period of time were Scandinavians and Germans, and you had, you know, Northern European countries in particular with vast forest resources and a need to stay warm and a desire for their buildings to last a long time. And a lot of the, during the settlement period in this country, a lot of those traditions and people embodying those traditions wound up in the Pennsylvania area.
Right.
And, you know, we refer to the Pennsylvania Dutch, which is basically the German community there. But there was also Scandinavians.
Swiss.
And the Swiss. And, you know, I bet everybody listening to this probably has a book somewhere in their house about that shows pictures of Swiss chalets and these incredible log structures that are hundreds of years old. Well, that tradition came here during the settlement period as people migrated to this country. And reestablished itself mostly in the Pennsylvania area. And why that was happening, I'm not quite sure, but it had to do with the river systems and the commercial trade and the economics of the settlement period in that area.
Right, and that, well, in terms of history, William Penn was deeding land to people just at the time there were, as I understand it, immigrants coming from Germany, and they were more accessible. And eastern Pennsylvania tended to look a lot like the German, especially southern Germany, where a lot of those people came from. There were a couple of waves, as I understand it, in Pennsylvania, the earlier Germans and then the later, what they call Schwabians and so on from the south. But the Pennsylvania Dutch bank barn became really, really popular, and that's passive solar again, or at least it kept it warm because it's built into a hillside. Mm-hmm. It's, and I'm going to have you talk about that. We're going to take a break in just a minute. But that's the kind of barn that I'm most familiar with, and I was really excited to see that you can find them here in this area in the mountains. Because they're so incredible. And as I understand it, they're very medieval. I mean, they're really the Middle Ages is when those kinds of barns were developed. And that's interesting, too, that has lasted so many years. That, you know, we're going on 1,000 years. They've been building that kind of barn with some of those same techniques because it's tried and true.
You're exactly right, Les. That's sort of the heart of traditional building technology, is finding a technique that works and staying with it. And sometimes new technology gets in the way and we're seduced into using other kinds of heat sources or whatever, when the best, you know, we used to talk about appropriate technology. Well, a bank barn is sort of the ultimate appropriate technology. And that tradition has lasted thousands of years. Even when you go to Asian countries, you go to Japan and China and many other Asian countries, the log building traditions or the wood building traditions, they're buildings that go back 1,200 years in age, and it had to do with really understanding through thousands of years of learning the appropriate use of materials. So that's exactly right. And talking about the bank barn, you know, the bank used to be called the Barnhill. And my last name is Barnhill. And it's, you know, as a child, I was fascinated with barns and have kind of stuck with the whole idea most of my life. But only recently learned that in Scotland, there is a little community called Barnhill. And it's named after this phenomenon, this technology of building a hill to access the hayloft area of some of these old ancient medieval barns. It's now more commonly called the bank, bank barn. But I loved coming across that and finding out the actual origin of my own name.
That's incredible. Yeah.
You know, Barnhill is a Scots name, mm-hmm. and my family came from Scotland. Madison County is dominated by bank barns. The older barns were with a mountain landscape like this, it's very easy to dig back into the hill. They needed access to that huge hayloft. The animals needed ground level access to the stalls and, mm-hmm. and the milking stall and all that. So it was a perfect way to use the landscape, use all the rock that was available by building a big stone retaining wall and building that bank, or in a lot of cases you didn't have to build the bank, you just dug back into it.
Right. They dug back into the bank, and on the lowest level it was stone. And stone openings and so on, with the wooden doors to go into the stalls and so on, and the whole upper half of the barn was wood, or is wood. What I think is really incredible that they figured out is having the animals down below with their manure and heat causes a little bit of a breeze and wind to pass up through the barn into the hayloft and out, and it helps to dry the hay. And what I have seen in Pennsylvania, the boards are in the hayloft are spaced far enough apart that the wind, the air, easily passes through and out the front door, and it helps to dry the hay, because you want your hay to dry out. You bring it in there, and it can't stay moist for very long, or it becomes actually a fire hazard, or it molds or whatever, but that helps to dry it. And I thought, it's the whole construction of the barn, putting the animals down below, enables that to happen.
It's a machine.
Yeah.
It's a wind machine. It's a, you know, wind is nothing more than a differential between air temperatures.
Air temperature.
And in some cases, humidity. So, yeah, it's wonderful to discover these natural phenomena like that in our old heritage structures. So that's one of the things that really keeps me going,
yeah,
is all these wonderful little discoveries.
Discoveries. It's really fascinating. Okay, well, we're speaking with Taylor Barnhill today, and we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back shortly. Okay, I'm back with Taylor Barnhill, and we're talking about barns in Madison County, our rural architecture, but specifically barns. And Taylor, you have been working with a group called the Appalachian Barn Alliance, which is based here in Madison County, to recognize and remember barns that have been built here just from the beginning. And what I'd like for you to do is talk a little bit about specifically your project, your research, what you're covering, what kinds of things you're doing. I understand there's some driving tours now that have resulted from your research. But talk about that, and then we'll get into maybe some of the specific kinds of barns besides the bank barns that you've been finding and researching.
Great. Yeah, the landscape in these mountain counties, and Madison County is a terrific example, is changing dramatically. When the tobacco program ended in 2004, a lot of our barns stopped being used. And when a structure stops being used, you know, a piece of roofing might blow off and doesn't get repaired, or there might be some kind of drainage problem that begins to rot the sills or the foundation in some way. So I can bet that everybody listening to this can name a barn somewhere near where they live that has begun to deteriorate. That's been a bit of an alarming thing for some of us who really value this mountain landscape and all the heritage that it represents. So the Appalachian Barn Alliance came together several years ago to, its primary goal is to document the barn traditions, the barn construction traditions, and that whole heritage as it relates to the farm heritage of Madison County. And by documenting, that means identifying certain barns that follow our criteria and getting access to them with permission from a property owner, taking lots of photographs. I think the average number of photographs for a barn that I am documenting is about 100, somewhere around 100 photographs. And this is of every angle and every detail you can imagine. Then take detailed measurements of that structure, draw those up into a set of architectural drawings, dimensioned architectural drawings, and also find as many people who understand the history of that barn. In most cases, these are family members, and in some cases, fortunately, we have a barn that is still in the original family, and it may go back five generations. And then I will do oral history interviews with those family members or neighbors or anyone else that knows about that barn or the particular tradition of that barn construction type. And all of this becomes part of an archive. And these archives will be kept at Mars Hill University. And the Appalachian Barn Alliance will have its own online archive. And copies will also go to Raleigh for the State Department Cultural Resources Archives and History. So we want to make sure that this documentation is done well, to follow the convention of archival
documentation and is in the right detail. So that's our primary goal. Now, beyond that, because so many people love barns and the agricultural traditions of these mountain counties, we know that with Madison County being a tourist destination, we think, okay, we're going to have tourists come to the county. This is part of economic development for Madison County. What are other ways that these tourists can enjoy their stay, stay a little bit longer, hopefully spend a little bit more money buying gas or food or lodging, whatever that might be. And so a spinoff project of the Appalachian Barn Alliance is to create driving tours in each township that allow tourists to drive from up and down these mountain roads and see some of these exemplary barns. We have a brochure that we've produced, a color brochure with photograph, maps, and a description of each barn and the family history, so that you can get one of these brochures and spend a half a day driving around, say, Laurel Township, visiting anywhere from 12 to 15 of these barns.
Right. Well, and these, I do want to mention to our listeners that you can pick up one of these brochures at the Madison County Visitor Center. And I think they're increasingly going to be online, but right now you can pick up the actual brochure, the physical brochure at the Visitor Center and other locations. I think they're also at the Welcome Center elsewhere. How many townships are there in Madison County?
There are 11 townships, and these, you know, the township is defined, one of the ways of defining a township is by the voting precinct. A lot of people know them as their voting precinct. So you have Beach Glen, Epps Chapel, Laurel, Revere Rice Cove, Hot Springs, Spring Creek, Marshall, Walnut, Grapevine, Mars Hill, and I'm sure I've left one out, but
pretty good.
There are 11 of those. And right now we have these driving tours and the brochures produced for Beach Glen, Laurel, and Spring Creek. And we're working our way through the townships. I'm currently working on the Walnut Township, which includes the Walnut Community, Upper Brush Creek, Big Pine, it's an interesting project, because you begin to realize that the settlement traditions and the barn construction traditions vary from one township to another. And it's not always apparent why. And so those barn traditions that I found in Beach Glen, especially the old 19th century hewn log livestock barns, are very different from ones I found in Spring Creek, for example. And all kinds of questions come up. You know, was there a settlement pattern and technology use east of the French Broad River that differs from that west of the French Broad River? So there's all kinds of intriguing questions like that.
In the latter part of the 19th century, I assume that there are more lumber mills coming on the scene than there were before, which, you know, the farmers would have to hewn their own logs, pretty much did all their lumber work. But did that start to happen where they could have a lumber mill nearby and get board feet to construct the barns, did that necessarily change then the architecture because they had access to those kinds of building materials?
It did change the architecture. It wasn't as clear cut as that. It's fascinating to me, these patterns that I discover. It has to do with the affluence of a landowner, the access to sawmills. Now, there were portable sawmills back then. They weren't all set up, you know, permanently on some stream bank, but there were these big steam engine or single piston fuel oil engine tractor type machines that would be moved around from one community to the next and power a sawmill. There was a lot of water-powered sawmills.
The water-powered sawmills, however, were incredibly slow compared to other kinds of powered sawmills. For example, I talked to a fellow up in Spring Creek, and he remembers his daddy taking a log down to the local water-powered sawmill to get some boards that they needed. Took the log down there first thing in the morning on the wagon. They got it set up, and by late afternoon, this water-powered sawmill had been able to saw one log. Very slow type of technology. Of course, they didn't know it was slow. That's what they had.
That's what it took.
Right.
Exactly. But when you mentioned the water power, were there? I just started thinking about when you talked about walnut as being an area you're working on. Now, walnut is. Is that going both sides of the French Broad River, that township, or is it just this one side?
It's both sides.
Both sides.
Yeah.
Were there other buildings, like mills, that's what I was going to mention, water wheels and, architecture along the French Broad right there at Walnut?
Well, Walnut is up on the hill away from the river, yeah.
But down by the river.
Yeah, you go down Barnard Road to the community of Barnard, which was... a big stock stand before the railroads came in 1882. It was a commercial center. There was a ferry there that got people back and forth across the river from Big Pine, Anderson Branch. But a little bit downstream from Barnard, in what was, early it was called Jewel Hill and was the first county seat of Madison County. Then they changed the name to Walnut later. But down the river was the Stackhouse community created by Amos Stackhouse. The Stackhouses had one of the biggest industrial sites in the state of North Carolina, one being a barite mining operation and a barite processing mill that was water powered on right there on the river. They built a dam across the river to channel the water through the water wheel, and also a huge sawmill operation.
Mm-hmm. When was that built?
Oh, now you got me caught. This was 19th century. This was
early 19th century.
The post Civil War.
Okay.
No, this was late 19th century.
But before the railroad.
Well, his operation started before the railroad, and he was instrumental in getting the railroad here,
right,
and setting up depots and railroad stops.
Right. I know he was, and one of our previous guests, Ray Rapp, talked about that and Stackhouse's importance with the railroad there. Well, these mountains are so inaccessible. How did they get the materials in and out of here before the railroad?
Well, it was by wagon. The French Broad is not a navigable river for any kind of commercial use. The Drover's Road, which, followed the French Broad River and later became the Buncombe Turnpike, completed in 1828, that was the interstate highway of the day. It was the Drover's Road was maintained. And I don't have all the facts on this, but a combination of tolls that were charged and a combination of cooperative endeavors from landowners and other folks who needed a job to maintain the Drover's Road so that you could operate a stagecoach, and mm-hmm. that was the main means of transportation for people, with Colonel Rumbo in Hot Springs being one of the stagecoach operators. The Patton family, James Patton, ran the stagecoach operation. But then the Drover's Road was the main commercial route through the mountains. I mean, this was the easiest way to get from the North Carolina side of the mountains to the Tennessee side.
Mm-hmm.
Very significant in terms of an economic generator. And the Drover's Road and those stock stands where the drovers who may have a flock of 20,000 turkeys or hogs or sheep or cattle or whatever it was, they needed to stay overnight. The animals needed to be fed. So this huge watershed, literally a watershed of farms were growing corn and wheat and barley and oats that came down these creek valleys and sold to the stock stands to feed all of these animals. So you had this huge economic generator, and early on, Madison County farmers went from just subsistence farming to a cash crop based or an exchange of crops for goods and services down along the Drover's Road.
Mm-hmm. And that's all 19th century?
This is very late 1700s okay. into early 1800s. And then, of course, the Buncombe Turnpike was chartered probably 1824 and, right. and completed in 1828. And then really became better maintained. And the stock stands were at a distance of, you know, the travel of a herd of turkeys, for a flock of turkeys, for example, you know, from morning till night. They needed that distance, and the stock stands were spaced accordingly.
Right. Well, I guess we kind of got off barns here, but I just started thinking about the architecture along the river with mills and with other buildings there, and did that relate at all to the way barns were made in the region, or they were very specific to the needs of the industry?
The early barns were a direct result of this superhighway that was going through Madison County, first called the Drover's Road and then the Buncombe Turnpike, because the early barns needed to support the growing of these grains that were traded and sold to these stock stands. So they needed good ways of storing the grain. They needed a good way of providing shelter for their animals that were, you know, the horse teams of horses or oxen or mules were the workforce to grow, to farm for these crops. And so they had to have a good barn. And the tradition, again, coming from Europe, was to build the first level of log cribs, which were the stalls for the animals. The second level was a big, spacious hayloft with good air circulation to keep the hay cured, keep it from molding, keep it from getting too damp, keeping it out of the weather. So that was the tradition. Again, they were usually bank barns built into the bank so that you could drive a team of horses into the loft area pulling a wagon of hay from the upper bank access point. So yeah, these commercial endeavors supported and were the rationale for the barn building traditions all around the county that had access to the turnpike. There's some parts of the county that had less access, and Sandy Mush community, that's another township that I didn't include earlier, it may have had better access to Asheville and Lester. Some of Spring Creek, because of its remoteness, may have had better access to parts of Tennessee right. and to Haywood County, Waynesville, over 209, over to Lake Junaluska. So you do get these influences from other surrounding counties, communities, and even Tennessee. But in general, because Madison County is just one big watershed that feeds the French Broad River, that watershed was also the transportation system. The old roads following the creeks downhill with heavy loads of grain or other produce to get to the French Broad River.
Okay, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the styles that you can see on the barns as you drive around. There's something specific I've seen here in Madison County, a kind of a chevron pattern on the sides of barns that I haven't seen anywhere else. Where does that come from, and why did they do that?
I love that. Yeah, these are the diagonal. This is the diagonal board siding that you see, and I've always been intrigued by that. Aside from being beautiful and a kind of artistic expression, it's primarily structural. You know, in any kind of frame construction, you need triangulation. You need to put in angled diagonal bracing to keep the structure, the vertical posts and the horizontal beams, you know, they want to lean one side or the other. And to keep them from doing that, you make structural triangles. And the diagonal siding was a very simple way of doing that. And some of our early barn builders went all out to make it also an artistic expression. Some of the older livestock barns also used this beautiful lattice work, and it was typically chestnut. It was sawn, so it had to be cut on a sawmill somewhere nearby, but they would install this lattice on the outside. The lattice was to allow for free circulation of air for that loft area, but it was also a beautiful, lightweight, structural component of the barn. So some of these older, late 19th century barns were just works of art, both in terms of craftsmanship, the blending and the use of materials and wood species, the roofing, and all those kinds of things.
Tell me a little bit about that. Now, you mentioned chestnut, and we're talking about the American chestnut here before it met its demise from a blight, but it was really prevalent here in Madison County and used for a lot of these barns. But when you just mentioned that a variety of woods were chosen, why was that? Why did they not choose just all chestnut or all oak or something like that? Why the different kinds of woods?
Yeah, it's again, it's another one of these. It's about technology and the appropriate use of materials, and the traditions taught the local farmers and builders exactly what to use, where, and when. And you know, we could do a whole program on that, but I'll try to be brief. There were certain tree species that were best for certain uses. Chestnut, for example, was rot resistant. It was bug resistant. The American chestnut tree was a dominant species. It's estimated that one out of every four trees in the forest in the southern Appalachians was an American chestnut. That's a phenomenal dominance of a species. And it was an ultimately useful tree. The nuts were food for livestock and wildlife. It, you know, the list goes on and on. But they often grew very straight. They, as big as they grew, it was surprising how fast they grew. If you come across an American chestnut out in the forest now, of course, it's going to be killed before it gets of any size because of the blight still existing here. But it's remarkable how fast a young sprout will turn into a 6-inch diameter tree before it dies. There's one I've been watching up on in the Shelton Laurel area that went from nothing to 6 inches in 3 years. It just grows like a weed.
Wow.
So it's it was a phenomenal material. Then you've got other species, the poplar was very useful in terms of hewing these big hand-hewn logs with the notching these log cribs and log cabins, the log houses of the settlement period. Pine trees, you get a stand of white pines that were very, very straight and very useful for poles and posts and rafter poles, tier poles, and purlins. And then oak for certain uses. You wanted oak. The white oak was the preferred wood for making split oak shingles, which was the roofing material up until metal became available in the early 20th century. So the traditions were passed down from one generation to the next on what wood to use for what purpose. So when you had a foundation sill, you wanted it to be rot resistant and bug resistant. And it's just remarkable to see how these buildings were used, especially when you walk into one of these old 19th century barns and you see a beam, for example, or what we call a plate. It's a beam that runs across the tops of these log cribs. And most often they run from one length, one side of the barn, all the way to the other. My barn is 53 feet long. It has 16 of these plates and sills that are 53 feet long, hewn square out of one tree.
Now, can you tell me, this is something I've noticed about these barns, and you pointed it out at a lecture you gave one time about these barns. How was this constructed? How did people get these enormous beams up so high? On the sides, going up really high? I mean, you can tell me how high these barns were, the square part before it started, but also what you just described with the plates. They're enormous and extremely heavy.
Yeah, we're talking tons. You know, my barn is an example that it's easy for me to talk about because I know it so well, but the outer sills, which were the big beams that sat on the rocks for the foundation, were chestnut. They were 8 inches thick, and they were 14 inches wide. They were hewn out of a chestnut tree, and the log that was dragged down off the mountain by a team of oxen or horses or mules was 53 feet long. It was tons in weight, even and green in
probably
most cases.
Quite a few oxen then, maybe even four oxen to pull something like that, huh?
I would have to imagine, yeah, it had to be more than a team of two. In most cases, they're working with gravity, bringing it downhill off a ridge line or someplace like that, because the barns and the homesteads were down in a valley or in a lower area. So they use gravity to their advantage. But gravity also would kill a team of oxen real quick if the log got away from
control,
them. So
yeah.
You read these accounts of how people managed to keep the logs from getting away from them. But it's incomprehensible how these things were done. In my reading and in looking at videos, contemporary videos of people doing barn raisings and that type of thing, where they're trying to use the original techniques, it took a lot of people.
Yeah.
Somebody told me that to raise one of these barns probably took about 20 men. The women were on the sidelines providing all the support, including all the meals to feed all these men. And the children were involved. They all had a job. And these men were neighbors.
Who would coordinate the building? Not necessarily the person who was going to be the barn owner. There are people who were more specialized in kind of being the foreman for the construction?
Exactly. There were community builders, and the names that I have come across most often in the Beach Glen community, because I know that township better. Joe Carter, Jim Carter, Preacher Corn, Jim Corn, over in Grapevine there was a Bob Hilton. These are the builders. These were the 19th century builders, and they learned their craft building some of these beautiful old vernacular Victorian farmhouses with all the scroll work,
right,
and the detailed woodworking or decorative woodworking. But their names pop up also when you hear accounts of this barn construction. And I'm pretty sure that Joe Carter, up in the Paint Fork, Beach Glen area, was involved in building some of those magnificent barns up there. You had to have craftsmen involved, because the craftsmanship of the notching and the mortise and tenon joinery and all of that, plus the technique of getting these huge timbers up into place, took a lot of skill and experience.
Right, and it had to, because, as you said, they were so heavy. I was just thinking if they had some techniques like making ramps or other ways, but maybe it was just blocks and pulleys and ropes and that kind of thing, and 20 men, obviously. But I just want to express to our listeners who are not from Madison County, but maybe you've seen barns like this, that they're each wall is really tall, and you see these enormously thick, big beams way up at the top. Did they get smaller as they went up, or were they pretty much the same size all the way up?
They got smaller only because they were carrying less load, or their structural demands were less. So they tended to get smaller, but the big beams supporting the roof structure of my barn are still 6 inches square, mm-hmm. hewn from a single log 53 feet long. And that's a lot of weight. Now, they would put round poles up against the sides as they went up and slide logs up that
way. So
they
slid them up the poles.
Okay. Yeah, for log construction. But once they got to the top of the ground floor and they were starting to frame the loft area, they would build a frame of the posts and the beams laying down on the loft floor, called a bent, and then they would hoist that structure up using ropes, block and tackle, mules, the draft animals pulling ropes, and then men with poles and spikes on the end of the poles to push those up from the other side. So that it's, if you look online at some of the Amish barn raisings, that gives you a pretty good idea of how
right.
some of this
and that's
is done.
What I think most people are familiar with seeing films or photographs of those kind of family. You think of it as a family affair with a farmer and his sons or the neighbors coming over to help. But I just started thinking, and you acknowledge that there were specialists who were architects and craftsmen who really came and helped with that. But it was a lot of labor, and so you needed a lot of hands and people who are confident in doing all that lifting and pulling and so on. It looks like we have run out of time. This hour went incredibly fast, but I think we need to have you back and talk some more about barns at a later time. But I want to thank you, Taylor Barnhill, for being with us today, this afternoon, and come back and see us.
Thanks, Les.
Okay, you've been listening to WART, and this is Madison County Days on Madison County Community Public Radio, coming to you from Marshall, North Carolina.